Shalom and welcome to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles.
We were reading about the similarities in the Jacob accounts and the David accounts with Tamar, right? Let me get back to my, I want to be very exact here. Right. Rebekah and Isaac and Judah and Tamar with respect to the tza'if, right? The veil, the use of the veil. All right. And that just opened up as you guys began to come on. I noticed another set of interesting parallels, which I'm just now working on. It's in my head. I will share it with you when I finish. It's not complete yet, but it's interesting. Anyway, okay. But so this whole notion of connectivity is not new. In a moment, I will read to you a midrash that noted the connectivity between David and Judah and Jacob. Okay. But here, listen to this one. Okay. And this is the oldest one. It's a tradition it's in the Bible itself. Now, can you think of a place? Maybe you can, where a reference to Judah and Tamar and her kids is associated with something related to David.
Would it be, that I don't remember offhand, but I'm just deducing, would it be something with the prophet talking about the kingship changing from the tribe of Saul to the tribe of, the tribe of Benjamin, sorry, to the tribe of Judah?
No. Good thought, but no. Because this is explicit. This is absolutely explicit. Verbatim. All right? I'll give you 5 more seconds. Time's up. You like that noise?
Yeah.
I learned that from Rabbi Ed Feinstein. That was at Camp Ramah when he was the director of the camp or head of the machon. I forgot. So he used to play these games. Well, I had to think of words, and if I didn't think of it, he'd go, Yotze, you're out. All right. So it stuck with me. All right, no, here we go. I'm reading the book of Ruth. Open up the book of Ruth. It's in the part where you find the 5 Megillot toward the end of the Tanakh.
And that was so obvious, all of us are blushing.
All right, chapter 4. Ruth, chapter 4. When do we read the book of Ruth?
On Shavuos.
When?
Isn't it Shavuos?
Yes, but you said Shavuos. I would have said Shavuot.
Well, I'm an old Ashkenazi. What do you want from me?
You Ashkenazi. All right. Get with the program. All right, anyhow. Yes. Chapter 4, verse 12. This is a part of the blessing that the people give Boaz when the birth of children is emerging, right? From Boaz and from the marriage of Boaz and Ruth, with the notion of children. Okay, so it says, "V'hi beitcha kebeit peretz asher yalda Tamar li Yehuda." Min hazera asher yitein adonai lecha min hana'ara hazot. May your house be like the house of Peretz, whom Tamar bore to Judah through the offspring which the Lord will give you by this young woman. Okay. And then it goes on and listen to this. Now go to verse 18. We're going to read those verses, just a list of names. We see where it goes. Okay. 18 through 22. Ve'ela toldot Peretz, Peretz holid et Chetzron. I'll just read the English translation. This is a line of Peretz, Peretz begot Chetzron. Chetzron begot Ram. Ram begot Aminadav. Aminadav begot Nachshon. Nachshon begot Salmon. Salmon begot Boaz. Boaz begot Obed. Obed begot Jesse. And Jesse begot David. So there's the genealogy all laid out. So this is Jacob's son, right? Jacob's son. And that son, I'll talk more about it in just a second, okay? So his son has that, and that the child of that son of Judah, tribe, Judah, David, Judah, yes, ends up being the great, 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 great of David. So there's a connection, okay? Now, here's what's interesting. It's even deeper. Tamar was a Canaanite, okay? So Judah's oldest son, Er, married Tamar, right? Er, we're going to talk about that in a minute. Er died, right? Then Onan had to marry Tamar because of the Levirate requirement, okay? But then Onan died because he spilled his seed. And on Shelah, the third son is left, and Judah had promised that Tamar would have him, but because he already lost two sons, there was hesitation. Maybe this woman is cursed. So it never happened. So, of course, Tamar steps in, and she pushes the whole thing, and in the end, she's vindicated. And that relationship with Judah, her father-in-law, ultimately results in the line of David. So, remember, Ruth is also a non-Israelite, right? She's a Moabite. And that identity stays with her throughout the book of Ruth. She's called Ruth HaMoabiyah. So she also is a non-Israelite. So both have a mix. So they're mixed marriages. Now, back then, by the way, it was perfectly clear that the household, the religion in the household was the religion of the husband, not of the father, not the mother. That's generally speaking throughout the Bible. The notion of matriarchy with respect to the religion of the son is late, it's rabbinic, basically. It emerges most powerfully during the rabbinic period. That's a whole other subject. I don't want to go into it right now. But anyway, so you see then that that this is the this is a very, very similar types of contexts. All right? So already the Bible is aware of the connection between Jacob's family and David. Okay. All right. Bert.
Yeah, if we were going to write a story about the origins of one of our greatest kings who wrote the Psalms, why would it start with a questionable, I mean, Tamar, it's questionable. She's playing the prostitute and, yeah. I mean, it's not a noble line. I mean, I guess it is a noble line, but on the other hand, it's not.
No, but that, I think you're asking the right question, but not for the right reason. Because remember, at the end, Judah says you were right, tzadakt.
But yeah, she was right, but it's not. It still is not the perfect family. It's not the Brady Bunch.
No, but the issue is, remember, I said last time, scholars suggest that in these early biblical traditions, the details of the Levirate responsibility may have evolved, okay? And this may be actually an inkling into a stage where the father-in-law could, as a last resort, play that role. That's what they suggest, because that same question was asked. Just a second, I see Mark, hold on. And so it's, you know, he just jumps, she does it, he says, you're right. So clearly there's nothing wrong with this. When he says, you're right, you are even more justified than I, she puts her approach to this at a higher level because the promise was made that there would be a male in that family to maintain the line of heir. Okay, that was an obligation that came with the package. So it says tzadakt. Now, maybe that's a biblical author trying to clean it up, possibly. But at the same time, the fact that she had to play that, make that ruse, was because Judah was remiss on his obligation. That's the whole thing. She did it not to have sex, not to gain pleasure, but to fulfill the mitzvah of perpetuating the line. His line, Judah's line was being, that's the whole point. Judah's line was being perpetuated through this. All right, now, so that may reflect that past situation. Just a second. But the point is, she's a Canaanite, and Ruth is a Moabite, okay? Now, you have traditions in the Torah that discuss these things. You shouldn't do these things. These are not marriages that are necessarily prescribed in the Torah. In fact, with the Canaanites, you're not supposed to at all. The Moabites, it's probably not, okay? Because of, you read the 10th generations, you can't marry Moabites. So, I mean, these are nations that are explicitly, they are not approved for marriage. That's the point.
What about Moses' wife? She was Midianite, right?
Yes. So that they are not necessarily.
So all of them had non-Jewish wives, non-Israelite wives.
Yes, of course. But you see, though, the answer to that whole thing is these are the ages when these concepts are being evolving into existence. Okay. And by the way, you know, again, people have suggested that the reason why the book of Ruth is there is because there was no concept of conversion yet, and that Jews, when they came back from the exile, were marrying women who were either mixed Jew, non-Jew, or non-Jewish. And the question is, what do you do with them? So in the end, Nehemiah said, kick them out. We cannot run this risk. Okay. And it is associated, some people, most scholars say, no, this is a little bit too simplistic. But some people say that the book of Ruth may be a reaction to that extreme measure in order to perpetuate the purity of the line. But the purity of the line had nothing to do with Levirate or non-Levirate stuff. It had to do with the people whom you were marrying for fear of exposure to idolatry. All right. So, and the whole point is these, even in the post-exilic period, concepts are constantly evolving, being honed, being modified until even during the rabbinic period. You have discussions in the Talmud. There are statements in the Talmud. They talk about what you have to do to convert. As to do you have to have a circumcision, or isn't a commitment to following Torah enough? Mikveh and Torah, when you need a circumcision, because it was the Roman period and a lot of people looking down at circumcision, among the pagans in particular. But not that conversion was a big deal. It didn't happen that frequently back then. But the point is, why make it harder? Make it easier. Let them convert without circumcision. No. But it's raised. It was discussed. And then dispense with, because that's part of the covenant. That's a covenantal step. It is hard. It's hard fixed in the tradition that you can't change. And up to this day in the traditional circles, that's the way it is. All right. Okay. So these are other elements that you see these stories have in common. Okay. Mark and then Tybel.
Christianity from its early origins, when it was sort of not completely distinguished from Judaism, from its roots, they took anybody and everybody into the fold, prostitutes, thieves, murderers. I mean, everybody was allowed into a big tent to build their cult or their religion. What we just reviewed was an unusual time in Judaism that allowed some type of assimilation with certain conditions. And, it was a very unusual time over the course of Jewish history to assimilate non-Jews and, pagans or whatever into the fold. But we were such a small people, we had to have some sort of ability to grow. And that seems to have been a growth period right there.
Well, it was. We don't know that how much the Jewish population grew. We know that there was severe losses as a result of the Bar Kokhba revolt. Much more so. The population in Eretz Israel was decimated.
By a third or more.
Yeah, exactly. Somewhere between 25% and 35%. Yes. Yes, exactly. Between people being killed because the battles were fierce, people running away, people being taken out, you know, as slaves and so forth and so on. Yeah, but I think the issue there was, yes, there was theoretically, and perhaps the Jewish element within the followers of Jesus, like James, his brother, that group, the traditional group who wanted to maintain circumcision and kashrut. Okay, so, but their hope was that by speaking in terms of a different kind of access to God through Jesus, okay, is something that the Gentile world would have been interested in. And they were much more akin to sort of where Paul was at the beginning. Paul, as well as the Jewish element within the followers of Jesus, the more Jewish element, let's say the more traditional element, they thought of expanding, you know, the getting Jews to develop a new approach to what has happened, what this man represented, thereby expanding and opening the door to further expansion. The point is, however, that both Peter and Paul realized that the circumcision thing was a no-no, because in the pagan world, because of Roman influence, generally speaking, it was a form of mutilation, and that scared them off. There's no question about it. But ultimately, and Judaism at the same time, the rabbinic tradition was becoming more and more isolationist, if you will, because they realized the potential danger in assimilation, and that there's no question. And they realized, especially after the war, and remember, you don't recall, but it's in 117, there was a big thing in Alexandria, where the Jewish army, Jewish soldiers were fighting against Alexandrian pagans, and they were getting shmeiced too. I mean, there was a severe loss of Jewish population in Egypt as well. So they were aware with the decline, but they were also aware of the fact that there was a tendency to move away from Judaism. There were so many numbers of sectarian groups operating in the Jewish community in Eretz Yisrael in the first and early part of the second centuries.
And as far as the time of Ruth and Tamar, wasn't it an assimilation growing time?
No, wait, there was, but we don't know enough. Have enough details to know the proportions of it.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, so Ruth and Tamar are not the same time. Tamar is centuries before that.
Yeah, but it seems to be a small window that was open to taking in other strange peoples.
But the tradition was that there was a strong feeling, we don't want to have anything to do with within our society, with these people, because there's a lot of hatred toward us. Okay? I mean, there was. And the Roman soldiers, when they were in Eretz Israel, okay, before and after the destruction of the temple, and through the period led to the Bar Kokhba revolt, and after the Bar Kokhba revolt, the situation in Eretz Israel vis-a-vis the Romans was very dire. They were soldiers. What do soldiers do when they rape? Well, they rape, they steal, they insult, they make noises. You know, they're not happy. The Jews were not happy there. Things settled down toward the beginning of the time of Yehuda HaNasi, around the latter part of the second century, going into the beginning of the third century, and things actually settled down in relations there. But the Jews by that time were locked in the Galilee. The Jewish population after Bar Kokhba, the whole center shifted from the south to the north. And that's where the Mishnah was born. Okay. That's where all the basic, the Tanaitic traditions were basically nurtured and developed in the northern part of the country. Jews could not go into Jerusalem, period. after the Bar Kokhba revolt. They couldn't go, technically could not go into Jerusalem till after the Islamic conquest. Okay? And so the Jews didn't like them, especially Amcha, right? The average Joe. The rabbis, I mean, we know that rabbis during that period did reach out to Roman officials. We talked about this before. We have evidence that in the patriarchal household, Greek was being taught so that they could have emissaries to go into the Roman world not so much in Rome, but even in Rome, Greek was the national language, the imperial language until around 230 or 40 of the Common Era. Greek, and they learned Greek, or maybe some Latin too. There's some Latin words that you can find in the Talmud. Point is, but caving in, you know, by doing away with these things was not on the agenda. They thought that was may even bring down the wrath of God even more. Okay, so I think that's what happened. All right, sorry, Tybel.
A few short things. And I'll put up one of my favorite Shavuos images. That's I have a bunch of them, but anyway, I found that. You taught me a word yesterday, Rabbi, tintillation. I didn't know that word. I liked learning that word. So I'm just about to say that I get to now say, because of what you were talking about, one of my favorite words in English in certain contexts, which is epispasm, which is the process of reversing a circumcision, what the Hellenizing Jews tried to do. I won't, for anyone squeamish, I won't go through the details of what it was, but epispasm.
Yeah.
Anyway, but the thing you want us to focus on words, so I wanted to say something that I thought of when you were talking about Tamar and Tamar's mother-in-law, whose name I don't remember, whatever, as Canaanites versus Ruth as being from Moab. The rabbis knew that Moabites were even more prohibited, so they got around it by saying, oh, it's only Moabites, in English I'll call it Moabitesses. In other words, that the prohibition, there's a part of the Talmud where they go through the prohibition was only about men procreating with the men, but not the women. I just thought that was interesting in terms of you're talking about what did you call it, a hard something, a step hard fixed in the tradition, and what is mutable, and that particular thing was mutable.
Yes.
And then the last thing I wanted to say was, when you talk about numbers is significant between 25% and 35%, probably even lower, population decimated, what we would now call the term chilling, a chilling impact on the rest of the population. I mean, not to go on, but I think we're seeing it now in the Jewish community around the world after the pogrom, where identifying, or what I call the driving Miss Daisy phenomenon, where whether it was the play or the movie where Miss Daisy says to her chauffeur about the bomber terrorists, but didn't they know we're Reform? As in, you know, we're the good Jews. Right. Why don't they, you know, the same thing like with the Peaceniks. Why didn't they go after the Orthodox for the Reform?
I hear you. Yeah. All right. I hear what you're saying. That's a different subject and I don't want to get into it. I understand where you're coming from. I see that it's happening, but there's a lot of other things happening in the other direction. And that's why I'm not sure where this is all going to end up right now. Okay. The mobilization of our anti-Semitism efforts has become much more active. That whole mobilization is taking place. We haven't seen the end of it yet. And I think, I'm hoping that they are able to devise means of being able to respond to that. And I think that will help a great deal, but it's not going to happen quickly. Got to be patient, but we got to keep working on that. Agreed on that one. Got to keep working on that. Absolutely. Yeah, there are Jews who are afraid to be Jewish. And that's happening, you know, trying to separate themselves. But what they don't understand is when these ideas get embedded within the psyche of another group, especially the majority group, it's there, and you can't allow that kind of senses, you know, sensitivity to become absorbed in great numbers. That's what has to be stopped. And I think we're right now, while the best we can say is we're working on it, it's going to take time. Somebody once reminded me that just recently that the Islamic effort to, you know, change the attitude of American culture toward Muslims and toward Israel, that effort has been going on for 25 years. You know, I don't think anybody came up with a master plan, but as it worked out, it has been going on in different ways. So we have to sort of move quickly to undo 25 years of brainwashing an audience that's totally ignorant about these things. I mean, if you look at the, there was a recent article about teaching the Holocaust around the country. And it was in the New York Times, actually, I think, around the country. And it showed very, very good. No, I'm sorry, it wasn't. I think it was in the Jewish Journal. I forget where I read things. Anyhow, it was a very good study, which showed how the Holocaust is being taught. Many states have that as a mandate, okay? But the mandates vary. There are some states where it's a clear mandate. Sometimes it's teacher's choice or local agency's choice or whatever. Sometimes there's nothing, okay? It's spotty. But on the other hand, that you can fulfill that with a minimal effort. And the point is, if we have to push to get more states, because this is technically speaking, the running of education programs is a state by state program. And, you know, given, you know, Republicans in general don't like national mandates. They want to preserve states' rights. Question is, would the population in this country, or let's say would the government, accept the concept of a national mandate saying this is what you got to do, this is what you got to teach, and don't no bones about it. But right now the problem is, even in those states where it's a mandate, how you do that depends upon the nature of the teacher, the local school board and whatever, what they're willing to do, how much time they want to spend on it. Clearly it has got to be a well thought out program that is being taught all over the country, because unfortunately, too many people in this country are totally ignorant as to what actually happened. Okay, and that's young people in particular. Bobby.
One of the ways that schools can meet the requirement is bringing classes to my museum for a tour.
Yes.
And I've got to tell you that my tour may be very different from somebody else's tour in what I emphasize. So there is a great deal of variation.
Yes, of course. But I think the tours that go into the, you know, your tour is the Holocaust Museum, right?
Holocaust Museum, L.A., yeah, Tampa City Park.
Okay. And I'm assuming that at the Wiesenthal as well, they have their tours are spot on these matters.
I don't know. I've never been. I've never seen their exhibit, but I understand it's not as focused on the Holocaust. Ours is, you know, 99% focused on the Shoah.
They deal with a broader picture.
Deal with tolerance. They deal with the issue of tolerance.
Yes, right. But I think that they get a big dose of Holocaust education.
I'm sure, but it varies from, you know, from docent to docent.
But you're saying even with Jewish institutions, it varies. Yes, that's what you're saying.
I mean, there are probably people who analogize the Holocaust to things I would never analogize it to.
Yeah, right. Of course. Yeah, right. Yeah. All right. Off subject. Let's come back over here. Well, the one thing that just popped into my head, though, and I want just to share this with you. Okay. And I this is it's related. This is getting back on subject. Okay. Back on subject. Okay. Jacob and family and David and family. Okay. That's our subject right now. Okay, so think about the use of garments in the stories. The use of garments. Very interesting. And I don't think anybody has raised this directly because it's broad. the use of garments as a means of, first of all, of deceiving, right? All right, this is clearly something that we see not only with Jacob, but also with Joseph, right? So Jacob uses Esau's garments to deceive Isaac. Mrs. Potiphar uses her garments to deceive her husband and get Joseph thrown in jail, right? Okay. So there's another instance of garments. And then you had the things that we talked about, the tzaif, right? The Rebecca-Tamar connection. And then what we're going to talk about soon, and something we talked about in class last night, and so this is going to be a review for Tybel and for Bert, the Kutonet Pasim, what's commonly called the cloak of many colors, okay, which probably means a fancy design cloak, whatever that means. So, I mean, garments are involved in this parallel as well. Okay, I Tybel quickly. I want to move on. Yes, go ahead.
Quick one. When one talks about garments, I understand you bounded it by saying use to deceive, but I think if you said garments about Torah, the first thing that people would think of is the specificity of the garments for the priests.
Yes. Okay, that's true. But you.
No,
also-
I mean, I just thought I'd toss that out there because it becomes an interesting contrast. I mean, yeah. The little bells and the pomegranates and the this and the collars and the breastplate. Anyway.
That's a good point. But I'm just talking, though, to use the garments in ways that are relevant not to, you know, to the service of God. Remember, those descriptions are built into the descriptions in great detail of the various elements that went into the building of the Mishkan, right? That is a whole priestly layout of what they represent. And yes, the garments are an important part of that because it's the identification of the people who are responsible, of the Kohanim. Right? Yes, great detail there. And it's also, remember, look at the details of the sacrifices as well. I mean, precision of how much of this, how much of that, which kind of is it a he-goat, a she-goat, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, all those little details, that's the priests and that's how they viewed the world, okay? Because it's all, these are sancta, right? And this is the word of the boss. And you don't argue with the boss. If the boss says this is what you got to do, this is how you got to do it. That's why Korach's guys got schmeissed, because they were tricked into doing that. Okay, that was a deception on Moses' part, but God told Moses to tell him to bring that. So God wanted to give creative means whereby he could justifiably destroy the 250 people. That's the story. Read it. All right. Okay. But the point is, I just want to indicate that's a different realm of ancient Israelite culture. You're absolutely right. That's why when we want to see details, I mean, you think about the counting of generations, years. We you know, what we talked about with Noah's Ark, the details of the priestly count, you know, this day and this month, right? I'm surprised they didn't put in what time it was. Okay, but I mean, all the details, that's the priestly mindset. But you're right. I'm talking, though, about other situations. And you know, I'm not sure, I haven't read the entire Bible. But the pivotal role that garments play in the lives of these people, it's fascinating when you think about it, and the impact that has on how activity actually evolves. When we talk about the Kutonet Pasim, we'll talk about that shortly. You'll see there too, there are results that come of what happens with those garments. That are very impactful. So it's not simply, you know, some kind of a theoretical thing. It actually has an impact on human interrelationships. So that's just something else I want to talk about. All right. So moving along. So that all of this about Ruth, to me, that was really like an awakening, you know, because I'm reviewing my notes here. This was already last week. I was reviewing my notes and, you know, I had written down based upon something that I got in another book, this Midrash that I'll read to you in just a second. And thinking, oh, that's old. But then I started to think, I said, my goodness, no, it's in the Bible already. That's really old. Okay, so this idea of the relationship, it's not an idea that just came up in the last 50 years. Okay, all right. Which means the ancients had wisdom. We should not discount the ancients, right? They had wisdom. We can learn from their wisdom. Okay, remember, one of my professors at the seminary, Bible professor, said Rashi may not have the correct answers, but he definitely asked the right questions when it came to understanding the issues in the text of Torah. He definitely had the right questions, as did the other greats of that time. Some of them had very good and good contemporary answers. Okay, so the ancients, there's still a lot of wisdom back there. Okay, Tybel.
Sorry, but I was looking back at Ruth chapter 4, verse 16. There's a link to Moshe where it says Naomi took the child, the omen word. There's a part, I don't remember the chapter and verse, where Moshe becomes the nursemaid to the Jewish people. But I don't have a concordance to see how many times omen, the root.
I know what you're saying, yeah. Yeah.
Aleph Mem Nun.
I know what it means. Yeah, of course. Yeah.
So I don't know how common it is, but that might be when you're talking about what the story of Ruth does. To me, that's another word linkage that makes it even more important.
Yeah,
because the idea of the male Moshe being a nursemaid is interesting.
Well, he's an omen, which means he's a caregiver. I mean, a nursemaid can mean, I mean, he can't suckle, right, a child, right? But he's the caregiver of a child. Yes. Yes. And I know what you're talking about. I'm just trying to think of the exact place, but I can't think of it right now. That's true. But again, what you need to do, and I'm not going to do it right now, is get into a concordance and see how often it pops up, you know, and where it pops up to see if this is a widely used term. As we're going to see in just a minute, some of the things we're talking about here are ideas that are not widely used. And the fact that they do pop up in these stories is an indication of a conscious effort on the part of somebody who wrote these stories to create the linkage. Remember, that's a whole big thing we're trying to talk about here, where later generations or the same generation. Okay. The Book of Ruth was probably written sometime after the return from the exile. Okay, sometime in the 6th century. That's what Bible scholars today suggest. No, you can make hard evidence on it, but based on language and based upon the texture of the story, et cetera. So they're suggesting that. And clearly, that's the Book of Ruth, right? The stories about David were probably begun to be written down sometime either during or after his reign. Okay, when you had royal archivists back then even who kept records. The interesting thing is that whoever kept the records of David put in a lot of negative stuff, as we've talked about already. If you've seen, David did some very nasty stuff. And the fact that they appear caused a lot of trouble for people trying to reconcile that in later generations. Either those are stories intentionally made up to cast David in a bad light, or they're real and they were preserved for reasons. My thinking is, by the way, why do you present David and Solomon and all the rest of the kings with all kinds of warts? The answer is to remind the Jewish people that these guys are human beings. They are imperfect. They are not deified. They shall not be worshipped, which is the reason why probably Where Moses was buried, we do not know, right? I'm sure that the biblical authors realized that if they identified the place where Moses was died and a shrine was built there, the people would be going there and worshiping him in some fashion, okay? And so therefore, the notion of humanizing, why is it that Moses ends up screwing his whole life up? The crowning moment of his life, as far as he was concerned, going into the visit to Kadesh Barnea, right, where he hit the rock instead of talking to it. Up until that time, he envisioned himself as taking the people into the land, seeing the fruits of all of his efforts. And Lord knows, the guy gave a total commitment to that. And yet he blows the whole thing in a rare moment of ego, right? A rare moment of ego where he says, do you think we, meaning himself and Aaron, do you think we can bring water from this rock? That was his first mistake. And his second mistake was hitting the rock with the staff that he wasn't supposed to hit with. And just talk to the rock and say, the Lord of Israel, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, commands that you bring forth water. And he didn't do that. Okay? And so he blew it. He's a human being. The great Moses is a human being. And there are other hints in the stories of Moses in his biography. You read it closely. Other hints of his humanity. And so he's not God. Kings are not God. And so one of the reasons to preserve all this garbage about the kings is to make that point. And ultimately, the people who put these things together were scribes of different kinds. Their loyalties may have been to the king. The loyalties may have been to the priesthood. Okay, maybe they are people from the north whose traditions were woven in at certain points when they came south because the people in the north did not like the concept of the Davidic line, you know, because that was the other country, so to speak. All kinds of reasons why these negative images were kept. Why do you say that Solomon had 700 wives and 300 concubines? I mean, my God. Now, maybe that means in the eyes of the ancients, this was some guy. Wow. Wow, what an amazing king, you know? On the other hand, it looks like this guy was the king because he was too tired, you know? What he had to do to keep those people happy, you know? Or on the other hand, at the end, more serious, he allowed a lot of these women to build shrines to their gods all around the area surrounding where Jerusalem. It says so. So he basically opened the door to the acceptance of forms of idolatry in the greater Jerusalem area. That's what Solomon did. That's not a good thing, is it? No. All right. I think Mark had his hand up whatever his name is, Bert, the bearded wonder over there. Go ahead. Yes.
So 2 points. First of all, you know, what implications do all these behaviors, you know, with all the warts shown, have for any idea of a messianic era? And then second of all, look at all the rabbis who are worshipped up in the Galil at their tombs, which is a form of idolatry. So how'd that happen?
Oh, well, that we know. Look, that's all over the place, not just in the Galil.
Uh-huh.
Not just in the Galil.
Okay.
That's a phenomenon that all religions have that. The saints.
Mm-hmm. Right?
There's people who were close to God, you know, and so therefore by invoking them, you feel that you are showing your faith in these people. It doesn't necessarily mean deification. Okay, it's not the deification.
Mm-hmm.
But I think in the ancients, though, given the whole issue of dealing with idolatry, which was a constant threat, right, even into the post-exilic period, remember, you had two huge, calamitous, historic moments within a century and a half of each other, in the fall of the north and the fall of the south, right? three temples were destroyed, three focal point temples, two in the north and one in the south. Okay, that has an impact on the masses. Has our God abandoned us? Maybe we should look at these idols. You know, so the other side is saying, no, that's the reason why. That is the reason why the temples were destroyed. Okay, think about that. Okay, so what impact did that have on the people? Right. So the whole notion was to try to get that out as much as possible and worship of humans. Remember, it's interesting. People, we've not done enough in terms of understanding Moses from a perspective of Egyptian culture. That is beginning to work itself out now. More and more people are trying to see how the descriptions of Moses in the Bible conform to certain norms or certain traditions that are in Egypt. Because what people forgot, which is that the Egyptians controlled Eretz Yisrael basically until the time of the Philistines, which is about, 1100 to 1250. No, no, sorry. 1000 to 10. No, no. Wait a minute. David stuff. So David controls them in the year 1000, right? So the Philistines were an issue up until that point in time. All right, they hounded the Israelites for over a century. All right, so that means that where was I going with this?
You were on Moshe's Egyptianness.
Right, yeah, that's right. Right, thank you. Yes, so but there's elements. The Egyptians were a powerful force in Canaan for many, many centuries. And residue of Egyptian religious culture exists in different places in the country. And as a result of that, the concern, so the elements that you see in Moses, just as an example, his being placed in a basket in the reeds, okay, of the Nile, that motif, which many have seen paralleling an Assyrian story of a king, okay, is actually, and in the face of a potential threat to his life, there are mythological stories about an Egyptian goddess who put her son, who was to be one of the pharaohs, in a similar situation to save his life. So there's an Egyptian element to that. Okay? And there are other little details that pop up in the stories of that period that point to Egyptian sources. So that's something you have to keep in mind as well. But that too was a pagan culture. So this whole notion of protecting and, you know, and dealing. And, oh, yeah, that's the thing. The pharaohs who became deified, and this is something I did not know until I read it in an article by an Egyptologist, and this is not secret knowledge. Most of the times the pharaohs were deified after they died, okay? Now, is it possible that that may be a reason why the Torah makes sure that we do not know where Moses was buried, because we don't want somebody to come and build a shrine there after he dies and pray to the god Moses. Okay, and that's a thought, but there's an interesting parallel there. So, you know, anyhow, so these are factors that lead into this whole thing. All right, anyhow, one sentence from, here we go. Midrash Rabbah, don't look it up. 60, paragraph 15. This is in a book by Shinan and Yair Zakovich, From Gods to God, The Evolution of Monotheism. Now, this is what it says in Genesis Rabbah. There were two who covered themselves with a veil and then gave birth to twins. Who are they?
Rebecca. Well, yeah. Rivka, and then Tamar.
And Tamar. right? It's in Midrash. So already they see a connection, a parallel in the accounts. So this is, again, that's just a further example of this. Okay. And the other thing to note is that, of course, both female, this is now me speaking, okay? Both female ancestors conceived of and implemented a deception that resulted in foundational Israelite covenants with God, one with Beit Yaakov, Yisrael, and one with Beit David, right? One with the house of Jacob or Israel, you know, Beit Yisrael, B'nai Yisrael, and Beit David, and the dynasty of David. Rebekah's deception results in Jacob's receiving the blessings that accompany the birthright, and his flight to Haran leads to the establishment of the children of Israel. Tamar's deception with Judah results in the birth of Peretz, who in the later traditions is an ancestor of David. Okay? And by the way, you notice what I just said. The children of Israel were created in Haran. And if you think about it, where that's the literal children, right? Jacob's 13 children were all born outside of the country, except for, well, let's see, Benjamin for sure. Question is, where was Joseph born? Was he born in Israel? Maybe the two of them, maybe they were the only two that weren't. No, Joseph was born already in Haran. It was Benjamin who was not born in Haran, right? But you got all, remember, you also have their daughter, right? Dinah. So he had 13 kids. All right, anyhow, point is, though, that it's interesting. This is an aside. Where was Am Yisrael born?
I would say Sinai at the giving of the calendar.
That's where their covenant was made.
In the Midbar.
Well, they were born in Egypt. They were born, the mass of people who came out of Egypt was the nation of Israel. They went to Egypt as a family. They came out of Egypt as a nation. Yes, the identity was solidified with Sinai, sanctified. The covenant made with the whole people took place at Sinai, correct. But in terms of the actual physical birthing of this, of those people, all happened in Egypt, right? The more the Egyptians oppressed them, the more they procreated. That's what it says in the Torah. And that was the whole idea. Same thing happened with Jacob and his family, right? While he was in that quasi-slavery situation, they had the kids. And that was those were B'nai Yisrael, literally. The children, the direct blood children of Israel Jacob. All right, Tybel and then Mark.
Just a quick one. I went looking for the book From Gods to God, Evolution of Monotheism, and all I got was a Jonathan Kirsch with a similar title. Who's the author?
Avigdor Shinan and Yair Zakovich.
Thank you.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, so when the children of Israel left Egypt, there were a lot of fellow travelers who sympathized with them and were oppressed, so they got out of Egypt too. You know, it's
sure, yeah, but we don't know whether they were not included in the census.
They weren't. They were
because the census only included the people who were the children. Met was a tribe by tribe thing. That's clear.
So their identification with the children of Israel wasn't enough, I guess, huh?
Well, we don't know.
Same thing.
There is a tendency to blame them a lot of the trouble that happened too.
For their tendency towards idolatry and everything.
Yes. Yeah. I mean, well, we don't know. The Torah is not explicit about that.
We have the same conceptual problem here in the United States. They say there's 5.8 million Jews, but the actual number, if you consider affinity and intermarriage, is between 8 and 9 million.
Well, and I don't know the answer to that.
Yeah, it's just a conceptual problem.
Yeah, that is not the amount of those people who actually live a Jewish life. That's what they're saying.
Uh-huh.
Does that identity govern their lives?
Well, it's an interesting question because I have it in my extended family on my dad's side. So they have an identity of some sort, even if it's food.
Yeah, but the point, right, but that's my point is I'm more concerned about the perpetuation of the Jewish people.
Right. It might end in a generation or two after they're gone.
That's right, so, because the assimilation rate in those, you know, in many of those situations is infinitely higher than it is in the Jews who have some active affiliation. Okay, but that's another subject, Mark.
Right, right.
All right. Now, these discussions are fascinating. So I guess we can do that. We're a small group of people. We have boundless time. We can do that. All right, anyway. Now, the next issue now we're going to talk about is both Jacob and David have a very problematic relationship with a father-in-law, right? Do you know, is that perfectly clear? Laban and Saul, right? They were not happy relationships. You could look at the chapters and verses. But those are themes that run throughout the length and breadth of their experiences, right? So that is another common phenomenon. Trying to think, do we know of other biblical personalities where a relationship like that played such a major role in their lives? Yeah, Tybel?
It's the opposite of troubled, but Yitro. I mean, one of our greatest parshas is named after the non-Jewish father-in-law of Moshe.
What are you talking about?
Maybe I misunderstood. I thought you were saying, do we know elsewhere in the Bible where there's somebody's relationship with a father-in-law?
No. Oh, Yitro. No. I said problematic relationships.
Oh, problematic relationships only with an in-law or with a sibling? I mean, it's...
Saying with a father-in-law.
Father-in-law.
Yes. I'm talking specifically about that element.
Oh, Tamar and Judah. He was her father-in-law.
No, but that ended up good.
Oh, you're saying it can't.
Ended up not good. They break, right? I mean, David and Saul, think about it. Jacob and Laban, they had to sign an agreement that they wouldn't cross the line and bother each other. That's the end of their relationship. They take oaths. They take an oath. Well, I'll stay on my side. You stay on your side. Fine. Goodbye. Okay. And it ended with rancor and anger. And the same thing with David and Saul, right? David had a good friendly relationship with Saul's son, Jonathan. But with his father-in-law, no, it never really resolved itself. And Saul got himself, of course, in deep water because of how he acted and how he managed his monarchy and what, you know, the whole story of what happened with him and with Samuel and what Samuel had to tell him about what was going to happen to him. Right? Samuel told him, your dynasty's ended. That's it. No dynasty. David's taken over. Okay. So, I mean, that relationship never resolved itself. Saul, my reading of Saul was that he was, I think I told you, he was bipolar. And literally, because there's times when he loves his son-in-law, and they're, oh, by the way, garments, I forgot. Sorry, I see your hand, Bert, just a second. Garments. When David at one point, when he had run away from Saul, he's out. I think this all happened in the area around Ein Gedi. And Saul and his boys Saul for the night was sleeping in a cave, right? And David goes in there. David is able to sneak into the camp with a knife, with a sword, and theoretically could have killed his father-in-law right there and then and there, but he didn't. What did he do?
Didn't he leave a token that he was there? Or was this the spider story?
Yeah, he cut off, I believe, he cut off a piece of Saul's garment and left a token of his presence. So when Saul woke up, he saw the torn garment and this other thing that identified that David had been here, and he didn't kill him. And David never gives in to that thing. He was told by his cohorts, get rid of Saul. No, I can't. I'll stay away from him. I can't get rid of him. And, you know, I think what the whole, my interpretation of that is a more of a political orientation, and I can't verify this, but it seems to me what this is saying is David did not want to, they did not want to set a precedent of the pretender to the throne killing the guy who was sitting on the throne. That creates a paradigm that is going to destroy the monarchy. You don't want to do that. It's difficult enough to preserve the lineages and so forth. But I think that is a reason. Either that was in David's mind, it was a real, because he felt an allegiance to him, and he felt this is the king. He was anointed king by God. What can I do? God made a bad decision, but he anointed him. I can't deal with this. And he knows he's going to become the king, and he doesn't want to set a precedent for himself, what people will say about him. And Lord knows they could have. Right? I mean, he did a lot of stuff as king that should have gotten kicked out. Okay, so there must have been some kind of sensitivity that I don't know if it was within David or the authors of the story. But there again, garments are used. Okay, so just fascinating point, and I'm trying to think of other instances. The priesthood is something else. But where in terms of an interplay among people, garments become a factor that is used for significant results. All right, Bert, and then Tybalt. I can't hear you, Bert.
There we go. So I totally buy the connection and similarities between the Jacob and the David stories. Okay, I think you've been very persuasive. I'm in.
Yeah.
But you're going to get to the why.
I will.
Whether it's accidental or whether there's some other reason.
Oh, no. Okay.
For parallels.
Yeah. I want to hold off on that. I'm sorry. Delayed gratification here.
Oh, you got me in suspense.
No, but I want to keep doing this because you're going to learn more about the Bible.
Oh, okay.
Remember,
I'll keep quiet.
This is Bible 101. This is not the story of David and Jacob. My whole point is to you to see, the one thing I want you to see is how these traditions maintain themselves. And there's an interplay within the biblical accounts. Witness the book of Ruth and the story of Judah and Tamar.
Well, are you implying that these happened at the time of redaction and whatever it was, 375?
Oh, I think the book of this. In a sense, I mean, I can't prove the timing on all these things.
Right. Nobody
can really, but I think the interesting thing is a lot of these things with Jacob. We'll see later on. There's a lot of J stuff going on there, which is old. And the redaction of those things is old. So a lot of these, that's why a lot of people think that actually, if anything was manipulated, it was the David account to comport more with the Jacob account to show that, you know, he did some bad stuff, but these tendencies were already present in the ancient Jacob. Everybody accepts Jacob. Jacob's Jacob, right? Jacob's Jacob.
So, although I have some questions about Jacob's character.
Yeah, so everybody did. Of course. He didn't learn from his own mistakes. Look at how he treated Joseph.
Right.
You know, that.
And he was a bit of a deceiver.
No, it's not just that. Preference for one over the others. That's not good parenting. And it clearly was an issue with all the Abraham. At one point, it looks like he really likes Ishmael.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And he wanted to protect, what's her name? You know, Ishmael's mother and Ishmael. God says, listen to Sarah. She knows what she's talking about. Okay. So, you know, all right. Anyhow, but we will get there. Okay. Guess what? It's not going to be a conclusive answer either. This is all a lot of hypothesis. This the existence of the parallelism is much more firmly grounded than is the answer to the question you raised. So you may not even get gratification at the end of this thing. That wasn't the purpose of my teaching this.
Okay. That's why the easy way out is God dictated it all to Moses on Sinai.
Right, exactly.
You may already have this on your garment list, and it may not loom as large for you than it does for me. For almost 20 years, whenever I can talk to people, whatever, I've been collecting evidence that there were only 9 lost tribes. Well, there were only 9, but why the rabbis liked the idea of the 10. But one of the pieces of evidence is when the prophet Shmuel rips a robe, a garment, in 12 pieces, but only hands out 11.
That's
as I say, it may loom larger for me because of my whole only 9 lost tribes. Yeah, but the point is, it's a prophet and a garment and handing it out and symbolism, whatever. I can, I'm blocking on chapter and verse. If you want it, I can email it to you.
Yeah, tell to me next time. That's very interesting. Yeah, it's not quite what I was talking about. I was talking about parallels. That's unparalleled as far as I can see. The only thing that I might that popped into my head is that from the get-go, one of the tribes never had a parcel of land.
Well, you don't want to get me down this, but we could talk about not just Don who moved, but Shimon and what happened.
No, I know they get absorbed. Yeah. I understand that, but I'm saying that from the get-go. Okay, independent of how those things evolved over time. But Levi, by definition, was not given land.
But he's not a tribe. He's a son, but he's not a tribe. The other two tribes are Ephraim and Manasseh.
He's one of the 12.
No, sons, but he's not one of the 12 tribes. Oh, I could jump up and down about this. He's 12 sons, but when you go to 12 tribes, it's...
No, I understand.
10 sons and 2 grandsons. It's not Joseph either. You want to say then if you're going to say Levi, I'm going to say not Joseph.
All right. Yeah. Okay. I got, that's right. All right. I hear it. Now I understand what you're saying. All right. Not okay. Yeah. But that, let me stop in just a second. Right.
And sorry, that tone wasn't respectful enough. Oh, Rabbi, my teacher.
Well, I see that. Then I don't have an explanation. It may be that that account developed. Remember, the loss of the land for Shimon and Reuben and Shimon, I think both, yeah? I think those are the two tribes that lost land, or they were absorbed.
Reuben didn't get absorbed. The only one who's absorbed is Shimon in the south. Shimon in the south got absorbed into Judah. So the idea that for centuries, Shimon paid tribute to the northern kingdom and it was one of the lost northern tribes, that's geographically ludicrous.
Yeah. All right. So that maybe that's the answer then. It's referring to Shimon. But remember, that account takes place relatively early in the history of the tribes, right? And so it may be that the processes that resulted in subsequent loss of territory or absorption, okay, may not have been fully worked out. So I don't know about the timing, but that's an find that source. Okay, that's very interesting.
I'm in search of it.
Thank you. Okay, Mark.
Yeah, these biblical archetypes, reflect some very deep-seated needs and functions in human nature. You know, they're almost eternal. But on the other hand, how the problems are worked out and how the archetypes are repeatedly followed, you know, it's like a modeling going on throughout Jewish history. So is it a combination of both? Like, what are the solutions? What are the problems? Yeah. We have it here, but it's never going to end. I mean,
that's a very good point. And I think that is I can't get into the heads of everybody, all the people who did the redacting and the writing of the biblical stories.
Right.
But by and large, what you see throughout many of the stories is all the warts of the human experience, of the human character, emerge. And that in most cases, making a generalization here, one way or another, there are consequences that come back and haunt them or haunt somebody because of what they did. And I think that that is a very disturbing, but on the other hand, a very honest assessment of what happens in the world. Think about world history. Isn't that world history?
Yes, it's constantly repeating in different forms.
Right.
The conflict.
Yes. And that's, I always say that the Bible, Genesis chapter 1, that creation account through the very beginning of chapter 2, the establishment of Shabbat, right? That is the ideal. That's the ideal world. Starting with chapter 2 and moving into chapter 3, 2 and 3 are basically the same story. That story begins the reality. And the reality is that the human being is who is created in the image of God, according to chapter 1, right, has great potential. Let's put it that way. It lays out great potential for the human being. But from chapter 2, 3, till the very end of the Bible, we see all the warts and problems. And if God, at the end of the creation at chapter 1, can sit back on Shabbos and say, right before he lit candles, and says, Tov Ma'od, boy, this is really, really good. What I have just finished here, this is great. Okay? It was before the human beings began to act. Once they began to act independently with the free will that he gave them, human beings become the biggest thorn in God's side. Nature he could control. Human beings, no.
Time for another flood.
That's the story of the Bible. It is.
And is that unique in religious traditions? I mean, don't most traditions, not show the warts and show their founders as in some ways very pure and special? I mean, saints, we don't, other than you were talking about rabbis as saints before, but we don't really have saints in the Jewish religion. And our tradition, and it's used against us, because we've been very open about what our problems were and how human we are. To me, it just strikes me as very, very different from other religious traditions in that sense. So is that
the case? I don't know. I mean, I don't know. I mean, for example, you think about the gods of the various pantheons that existed in antiquity. Okay? The gods. You see their warts, right? The gods. Our God doesn't have warts, right? And if he has them, he works on it. But the point is, the Bible has taken the definition of personae and taken all of the issues that the pagans had with their gods. Read the creation accounts. Read the stories. They're all in there are two books of the ancient Near East. In documentary evidence and archaeological evidence. Read those stories. They've been out around. Pritchard is the guy who did that decades ago. Read the stories. They have fights. They kill each other. They have rape. Now, this is a God to God. Okay? That's the Bible takes that away from our God and dumps all of that on the people. That's basically what I think has gone on here, because God is God and people are people. That's the whole point.
And after all,
but basically the Torah is saying, it's like a parent talking to children. This hurts me more than it hurts you. I told you what to do. If you do that, things are going to be good. You didn't do it. So don't come yelling to me. Fix it.
Or and Yisrael is a God wrestler.
Right. But that's self-imposed. God did not necessarily want it. He was hoping not to have to wrestle with Israel. But Israel decided, I'm going to wrestle with God because I got free will. I have intelligence. I know a lot. Yeah, you do, but you think you know a lot. You don't know that much. And I think that's the reason why both the Rambam and the Zohar say the same thing. We will never comprehend God because we're only pea-brained human beings. They're, even though Rambam tries to exalt the power of the intellect, right? And the Zohar wants to exalt the power of the mysterium, right? And human beings with proper orientation could get into that. But those human beings are few and far between, right? So, I mean, it's a different perspective totally. But yeah, we are a tough bunch. And the whole question is, God said, I will never destroy the world again with a flood.
Do it with an atomic bomb.
Then that's not going to be God.
I know, but we'll blame the wrong party.
Now, it's possible that a large meteorite or asteroid is going to crash into the Earth at some point in time, like it did 75 million years ago. And that could destroy us. But notice, it didn't destroy all life, right? It did not destroy all life. So again, maybe at some point God's going to say, I give up. Asteroid! You know.
I don't Microbe.
Microbe, right? Yes. COVID, come in, yoo-hoo. I don't know. All right. Okay, what time is it? All right, it's time to stop. We'll stop here. All right, next time we're going to move on. All right, we'll deal one final point. Okay, so the troubles with the fathers-in-law, we understand. And the second point, and again, this is something I'm not going to, there's not a lot, it's obvious that both David and Jacob ran away from a threatening blood relative. Jacob ran away from his brother Esav, and David had to run away from his son Avshalom. And in both instances, at a certain point, they end up in a place called Mahanaim. Okay? Mahanaim was one of the centers that David had set up for himself on the periphery of his kingdom. Right? It's probably in what's today Jordan, if I'm not mistaken on the map. And of course, he regroups there when he's coming to take back from Avshalom. But his son, I talk about blood relatives here, not fathers-in-law. Okay, his son rebelled against him. And by the way, Jacob also had a son who, in a sense, rebelled against him. And both of them lay with women who were the concubines of their fathers, right? Reuven slept with Bilhah in an attempt, apparently, to prevent her from moving up to Rachel's status, thus protecting the status of Leah. That's how contemporary Bible scholars explain it. Because if you look back at how concubines could be elevated into full-fledged wives, that could happen. But if somebody defiles them, which is what Reuven did, and it says in the end, when Jacob curses Reuven, he says, because you climbed into my bed, right? And what does Absalom do with David's concubines? He takes them up to the roof, into the roof of the palace where everybody can see, and he has sex with them publicly. Exact same thing. And so Jacob had to deal with two instances of blood relatives who gave him trouble, right? Reuven, well, that's not directly him, but it had an impact. And secondarily, Esav. David had to deal with Avshalom. Okay, so again, but sons who and blood relatives who make life miserable for you, in addition to your fathers-in-law. So you want to talk about love within the family, right? Actual families, ha, 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 ha.
More dysfunctional. Yeah,
we're experts at that. We know all about that. We know all about that. All right, so I'll see you. Now we have two more sessions.
You have been listening to another in our series of podcasts from Temple Beth Am, a dynamic center for conservative Judaism in Los Angeles. If you enjoy these podcasts, we invite you to write a review on the Apple Podcast site or wherever you get your podcasts. For more information about Temple Beth Am Los Angeles, go to tbala.org.